and welcome to episode 22 of the Rocky Mountain Mason podcast. I'm pleased to say that with our current download rate, we have entered the top 5% of podcasts in the United States, at least according to Buzzsprout.com. We're very grateful for your listening. Today, I'm pleased to bring to you Freemasonry on the Frontier, the role of Freemasonry in the forming of the state of Colorado. And of course, we will conclude with Chapter 4 of De Occulta Philosophia Libri Tres. And if you like this content, please consider becoming a patron. You may become a patron and support the show by visiting our website, www.rockymountainmason.com, and clicking on the Support the Show link. Please also consider subscribing to our magazine. You may do so at www.rockymountainmason.com. Subscription costs $33 a year. You get 4 64-page glossy magazines in the mail. The magazine contains content of interest to Masons wheresoever dispersed and is not restricted to the Rocky Mountain region. We also have a new publication that might interest you called The Esoteric Mason. Find out more information at esotericmason.com. Our very first issue of that publication will be coming out soon. Our pre-publication rate of $25 is still available. This is a biannual publication, 40-plus pages, glossy, in the mail, containing content of interest to Masons who are philosophical. And now sit back and enjoy Freemasonry on the Frontier, the role of Masonry in the founding of Denver and the state of Colorado. By the mid-19th century, the region now known as Colorado was still unsettled. The Cheyenne, Arapaho, Kiowa, Ute, Navajo, and the fearsome Comanche, among other tribes, remained active in the region, covering an area from modern-day Texas to Nebraska and beyond. Indian country, vast, disorienting prairies beneath unpredictable mountains where the sky swallowed everything and men disappeared. By the latter 1850s, tales of gold excited exploration and ultimately settlement of the eastern plains just shy of the Continental Divide. They came from Georgia, Kansas, Nebraska, Missouri, California, from as far afield as destiny could reach to pan the streambeds and stake their claims. Municipality inevitably followed, felling the forests and carving up the land into the exacting pattern settlement required. With the development came administration. With adjudication came law. And alongside the Constitution's self-assembly necessarily enumerated, in the very elections that stratified the unruly crowd into self-governable units, in the tempering of passions that imposed will like a wedge, the great light of Masonry shone, stringing lamps along the plaza, up into the shadow of the mountains. In 1806, by order of President Jefferson, Zebulon Montgomery Pike, member of Lodge No. 3 in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, set out to map the Louisiana Purchase, a roughly 828,000 square mile swath stretching north-northwest from the Gulf of Mexico up into Canada. His name still adorns Pike's Peak, outside of modern-day Colorado Springs. And until statehood was attained in 1876, the region now known as Colorado was widely referred to by his eponym, Pike's Peak Country. By the early 1850s, prospectors were turning away from California. Rumors of the color in the Rockies drew some explorers from the beaten track, down from Fort Laramie, Wyoming to the north, and from the Santa Fe Trail to the south, to brave the granite-tipped high ground of the Rockies. But reports were faltering. In 1858, on reports from Cherokee contacts, William Green Russell, member of Blue Mountain Lodge No. 38 of Darlanega, Georgia, organized a party to search for gold in Pikes Peak country. Now, the name Dahlonega is it's the county seat of Lupkin County in the Georgia gold country, and it's derived from the Cherokee word Taulauneka, meaning yellow money. William Green Russell told the Leavenworth Times, printed on October 19, 1859, that my opinion that rich mineral treasures lay concealed in the Rocky Mountains had been strengthened in the meantime by numerous letters written by natives of Georgia who had emigrated to western Arkansas and the Indian Territory. They stated that some of the Cherokees had found gold at different points in the South Platte Valley in 1850 and 1852. When I left eastern Kansas on the southern or Arkansas route, my company numbered 18. But on the way, we fell in with a party of Cherokees and a company of Missourians, who were also in search of the supposed gold, so that we numbered 101 males when we reached the base of the Rocky Mountains. The Russell Party, as it came to be known, arrived at the confluence of Cherry Creek and the Platte River on the 23rd of June, 1858. Interestingly, in his History of Denver, Jerome Smiley records June 24th, which is St. John's Day, a day quite sacred to the Masonic fraternity. And they prospected the vicinity until the 6th of July, when the group broke, leaving only 13 to continue the search. Among those who stayed were Levi Jasper Russell and William McFadding, both Masons. Small placer deposits incentivized continued exertions, and the party panned up into the mountains, to the west and the north, returning to the confluence of Cherry Creek and the Platte River in August and again in September of that year. By early October 1858, William Green Russell had amassed $300 to perhaps $400 worth of gold, mostly flake. With his youngest brother, J. Oliver, Russell set out for Georgia on the 15th of October, 1858, to raise funds for expanded operations come the spring thaw. Levi stayed behind, along with the remainder of the party, including Masons William McFadding and R.J. Pierce, to build a cabin and survive the winter months. This cabin, the Russell-Smith Cabin, as it came to be known, was likely the first tiled recess where the gentle light of masonry was caused to shine. Others were beginning to arrive. John Easter had organized the so-called Lawrence Party from Lawrence, Kansas, motivated by reports of gold circulated by a Delaware scout called Fall Leaf, who found ingots in the Rocky Mountains in 1857 during an expedition by the War Department to hunt down the Cheyenne. The Lawrence Party had set out to Pike's Peak Country in the spring of 1858, directing their exertions south around the Sangre de Cristo Mountains, and they turned north after reports of the Russell Party's successes, though menial reached them, arriving nearby on the 4th of September. Of note, the Lawrence Party was the first to incorporate a township, laying out a surveyed plat north of modern-day Denver, which they called Montana City. Within a few weeks, 15 to 20 small wood cabins were seen strewn between the burrow holes and the makeshift sluices churning the placer of Montana City, about a mile north of where the Russell Party had made their first discoveries, around Dry Creek and Ralston Creek. But Montana City would prove short-lived. Settlement began in earnest down by the Russell-Smith Cabin at the confluence of Cherry Creek and the Platte River. On the 10th of October, 1858, a party arrived from Iowa, under the leadership of D.C. Oakes. Daniel Cheeseman Oakes, or a close relative with the same initials, appears in the proceedings of the Grand Lodge of Iowa in 1853, listed as Tyler for DeWitt Lodge under dispensation. However, there is no record of his membership anywhere preserved in the Grand Lodge of Colorado. Oakes wrote extensively about gold in the Rocky Mountains, and at some point in 1859, with dreams dashed, a disgruntled miner, returning with empty pockets, erected a fake headstone along the Platte River route to read, "Here lies the bones of Major Oakes, the author of this goddamned hoax." Then, on the 20th of October, a third party from Omaha arrived. On the 24th of October, a party of 58 arrived. Consolidated at Fort Kearney, it included men from Kansas Territory, Missouri, and Nebraska, and one woman. With them was William M. Slaughter, a Mason. On the 27th of October, the merchant C.H. Blake arrived with his partner, A.J. Williams, bringing a considerable stock of mining camp merchandise. Blake was a Mason, after whom Blake Street in present-day Denver is named, and would become the senior warden of the first lawfully constituted lodge under dispensation in 1859. By the end of the month, more had come in, including Henry Allen, leader of a party from Council Bluffs, Iowa, junior warden of Bluff City Lodge No. 71. Henry Allen appears to have been very active in formalizing masonry among the frontiersmen and was a principal force behind the move to statehood, albeit preferring the name Jefferson to what would become Colorado. Dr. Levi Russell, William Green's brother, the first prospector to settle in the area, records the dramatic change come the autumn of 1858. In early October, he was returning from Fort Garland with supplies for the winter. Upon his return, he recalled the following. "When I got back from Fort Garland, having gone on ahead of the others, past the middle of October, I found the Russell cabin finished except the chimney and occupied by the builders, with some Arapahoe Indians camped nearby. I also found that during my absence a considerable party headed by D.C. Oaks had come up the Platte from Omaha and joined our camp. Other parties soon came in, among them being Henry Allen, William Slaughter, and, I think, Andrew Sagendorf. Upon my return, our double cabin was the only structure on either side of Cherry Creek, and no other was begun until we started to organize a town company, which we did in a few days." It is exemplary that the three names he recalls, Henry Allen, William Slaughter, and Andrew Sagendorf, were Masons. By early December of 1858, it is estimated 250 to 300 people had taken up settlement at the confluence of Cherry Creek and the Platte River. Masonic communication arose almost contemporaneously. Probably by early November, a group of Masons had established the requisite number and a regularity of proceeding, if not a regularity in recognition, operating a time immemorial rite. History records three accounts of the first meeting of Masons in what would become Colorado. The first is recorded by George Byers Clark, the Grand Historian of the Grand Lodge of Colorado, and published from testimony given by the watchmaker J.D. Ramage, member of Cataraqui Lodge in Kingston, Canada, who, according to his recollection, arrived at Cherry Creek on November 3, 1858. And he said, "After retiring that evening, we heard someone calling out, 'Ho, that tent there!' One of the boys got up and asked if he were calling to us, and he replied that there was a man in the tent whom he would like to see, and at the same time making use of a Masonic expression. I then arose and went out. Our caller proved to be Brother Henry Allen, afterwards master of Number 5. He told us that there were five Masons meeting in his cabin that evening, and having heard that I was a Mason, they invited me to attend. I accompanied Brother Allen to his abode, and there found Brothers W.M. Slaughter, Charles Blake, Dr. Russell, Andrew Sagendorf, and I think George Lehow. These brethren, together with Brother Allen and myself, made the first seven Masons, according to my knowledge and my belief, who ever met in Colorado, having in contemplation the application for a charter and a seven who stuck together, as Masons should, through thick and thin." The second account was recorded in a letter by Andrew Sagendorf, which was relayed by H.W. Woodward, Grand Master, in his address, Conditions of the Craft, given at the 52nd Annual Communication of the Grand Lodge of Colorado in 1912. The first meeting of Masonry in Denver was held in W.G. Russell's cabin on Perry Street, near the site of the first bridge, early in November 1858. The exact date I cannot give. Of those present, I remember Jim Winchester, Bob Willis, Henry Allen, Judge Slaughter, Samuel Bates, W.G. Russell, C.H. Blake, O.E. Lehow, J.D. Ramage, and myself. Doubtless there were others present whose names I am now unable to recall. Brother Winchester presided at that meeting, but as he was absent much of the time, Brother Henry Allen generally occupied the worshipful master's station. No stated time or place of meeting was observed. It was generally once a week and at the most secure and convenient cabin. The third account of the historic beginnings of formalized masonry in Colorado was given by A.E. Pierce at the annual meeting of the Society of Colorado Pioneers in Denver on the 13th of December in 1898. And he stated, It may be of interest to some to note that the first Masonic meeting was held in a log cabin owned by Sagendorf and Lihau, December 10th, 1858. In the same place, a banquet was served to commemorate St. John's Day. There were present at this meeting Andrew Sagendorf, O.E. Lihau, Jim Winchester, Bob Willis, James Ramage, Dr. L.J. Russell, and Jim Pierce, possibly one or two others whose names I have not obtained. Now, Henrietta Bromwell, daughter of the famous Freemason H.P. Bromwell, relays a fourth account, and she claims that the Rocky Mountain News April 8, 1889 issue states that McFadding, with D.D. Hoag, Mr. Green, James Winchester, Henry Allen, Robert B. Willis, Andrew Sagendorf, met at the cabin of Dr. L.J. Russell in Auraria on Ferry Street, just below Blake, on an evening in December 1858, when for the first time Masons met together in solemn council in the Pikes Peak region. However, to date, I have yet been unable to corroborate this source. So it is probable that the early November date is the more accurate, since J.D. Ramage is recorded as opening his shop, a wooden cabin where he also dwelt, in early December, which would take time to construct despite the ample timber available, and his memory records him being hailed from his tent. Among these names listed, in all three accounts of the meeting, we note a good proportion of Masons who were part of the Russell Party and were integral to the founding of Auraria. Now, the St. John's Day feast is recorded by George Byers Clark in his Masonry Came to Colorado, and is worth sharing for the details it provides of life on the frontier. And I quote, "When December 27 of 1858 came, there arose in the little Auraria group the true Masonic desire to celebrate St. John's Day in fitting manner. A sumptuous dinner was prepared for the 26 Masons who had now arrived. The story of this banquet has become a classic in Colorado Masonic history. The room, a 16-by-16-foot cabin. Tablecloth, a clean sheet borrowed from a Mormon family recently arrived. Chairs, none. Menu, pork, beans, biscuits, coffee, wild game. But it was a St. John's Day feast, regularly celebrated for the first time in this prairie wilderness." By latter October 1858, two townships had been incorporated at the confluence of Cherry Creek and the Platte River. The first was St. Charles, incorporated September 24, 1858, by men from the Lawrence Party, who determined that the location east of Cherry Creek would be more suitable than the small settlement they had begun at Montana. By the 2nd of October, they had succeeded in surveying a 640-acre parcel. They staked their claim near the corner of what is now 14th and Larimer Streets, marked the city with a four-log improvement, adopted bylaws, and elected their officers. There were nine initial stockholders of the town, none of whom are known to be Masons, including two trappers who had resided as traders in the region, William McGar, also known as Jack Jones, and John Simpson Smith. McGar and Smith were, and I quote, "squaw men." Both had taken Cheyenne brides and lived by trading in the region. Their participation in the town company was deemed essential to stave off incursions by the Cheyenne and Arapaho, some of whom were camped nearby. Now, there's an enjoyable account of these two figures preserved on the record by E.P. Stout, after whom Stout Street in Denver takes its name, who arrived at the mouth of the creek on the 26th of October in 1858. And he states, "We were met by Jack Jones," that's William McGar, "and John Smith, traders with the Cheyenne and Arapaho Indians, who were living on the site of Denver. That evening, these two traders invited us to visit them and feast with them. We did so, and were treated to a good meal provided by Jones's squaw wife. It wound up with a hot whiskey stew, made from whiskey distilled from wheat and called Taos Lightning. From the effect it produced on Jones and Smith, one would readily have concluded that it was a genuine article of fightin' whiskey. When it began to take effect, those two gentlemen seemed to be seized with a fiendish desire to slaughter one another, and with their Colt's revolvers commenced a rapid fusillade upon each other. As that kind of entertainment was rather too vigorous for us tenderfeet, we managed to slide out through the darkness, making our way to our own tents, leaving our hosts to the tender mercies of each other, and expecting to find next morning both of them riddled with bullets. On the contrary, before the sun was fairly up, both of these gentlemen came over to our tents to apologize in the most humble and contrite manner for the disgraceful and humiliating spectacle they had made of themselves before their invited guests. We came to the conclusion that it had been merely an effort on their part to impress us innocents abroad with their wonderful bravery. Magar is something of a tragic figure. The street named after him would be renamed, and he would perish in the city jail while locked up for public drunkenness in 1867. Now, bearing this in mind, then, we perhaps see the improvidence in the incorporators of St. Charles's next move. The seven Lawrence men elected to head back to Kansas to return in spring and thus avoid the harsh winter on the frontier. Their reasoning included acquiring a formal charter for the township from the governor. But in 1855, Kansas Territory had recognized Pike's Peak country as Arapaho County. However, this was nonetheless Indian land. There was no real legal claim to the land at all. It wasn't until the signing of the Treaty of Fort Wise at Bent's Fort in 1861 that the Cheyenne and Arapaho would formally cede their lands. Thus, it is unclear why a charter from the governor of Kansas would really aid their claim, other than perhaps as added ethos to stave off competition, and perhaps as a ready reason to vacate the frontier in winter for more commodious and orderly surroundings back in the States. Anyway, so they left St. Charles, a fledgling claim, in the hands of Magar and Smith. Now, this was a mistake. Both Smith and Magar were already active with the Russell Party, which had settled on the western side of Cherry Creek. Smith and Magar would become equally active with the Denver City Town Company in short order. En route to Lawrence, Kansas, the Lawrence Party passed by a multitude traveling the Arkansas River, heading for Pike's Peak country. Perhaps realizing the danger, they sent back Charles Nichols to build a dwelling upon their claim and encourage settlement within its borders. But upon his arrival, Nichols' efforts were unfruitful. Without the benefit of a network to familiarize himself, he remained a stranger and proved unable to secure assistance in building a cabin. The four-log improvement was not sufficient to ward off claim jumpers. He ultimately failed to commandeer necessary resources or labor. Now, our Masonic brethren, however, were more successful on the other side of Cherry Creek. While their incorporation of Auraria was second to St. Charles, the records preserved show a more practiced hand at administration of the social contract. In his History of Denver, Smiley specifically notes this distinction, writing that the record of the Auraria Town Company is well kept, in neat, legible handwriting, and in good form. It affords evidence of systematic business-like methods and of an intention to promote the common welfare by affording all who were then here an opportunity to unite in common action. In these features, there is a marked contrast to some of those appearing in the record of the St. Charles Enterprise. On the 30th of October, 1858, the parties camped on the west side of Cherry Creek met and formed the Auraria Town Company, choosing the name Auraria from the Latin word for gold. Brother William McFadding was elected to chair the meeting. The well-kept minutes were the product of A.J. Smith. McFadding and Dr. Russell were members of the committee charged with drafting the bylaws of the corporation, the first law of the land, so to speak. One wonders if their ready recitals of the officers' duties may have assisted in their drafting the terms. The constitution of the Auraria Town Company stated in Article 4, for example, that it shall be the duty of the president to preside over the meetings of the board, to preserve order, and likewise to sign all certificates of shares, and to discharge all duties usually devolving upon the president of meetings and companies. And the duties of the secretary included, inter alia, to keep a record of all documents and papers relating to town property, and to notify stockholders of all assessments and when to be paid. At the first election of officers for the Auraria Town Company, held on the 6th of November, 1858, just 3 days after Ramage's account of the first meeting of Masons in the region, McFadding was voted in as president, with 84 votes. Dr. Levi Russell was voted in as secretary, with 84 votes. And Henry Allen was voted in as director, with 84 votes. J.H. Dudley, voted in as vice president, may have been a Mason too, although I've not been able to confirm this. However, he did share a cabin with Andrew Sagendorf, who, as we know, was a Mason. And Sagendorf's cabin, as I mentioned earlier, was regularly used for the early Masons' meetings. Thus, if Dudley were not a Mason, such use of his home might have been inconvenient, requiring his absence whenever the weekly meetings happened to be called there. The judge of the election was William Slaughter, also a founding member of Auraria Lodge. Thus, we see Masons organizing the first lodge, as well as the first township proper, contemporaneously. In 1860, the most valuable land in the region was located in Auraria, valued at $1,500 to $2,000 a lot. It is interesting to note an entry in Smiley's History of Denver regarding the emergence of the rival Denver City that would be established over the St. Charles claim across Cherry Creek. Smiley notes specifically, and I quote, "Denver City was in fact a little frontier business enterprise in real estate and was the first distinctive, successful movement of that kind on the South Platte. The Aurarian proceedings having had more of the brotherly love element in them." A day after William Larimer's Leavenworth party arrived at Cherry Creek on November 16, 1858, and having spent the night with William McGar and John Smith, who were meant to be protecting the St. Charles interest, and after indulging in a pot of frontier whiskey, brewed by their hosts, all the secrets of the St. Charles enterprise were liberally shared, and the St. Charles claim, lacking any substantial building to warrant its existence, was unceremoniously jumped. Concurrently, the Denver City Town Company sprang into existence. Attempts by Charles Nichols, sent back to protect the St. Charles interests from such a situation, were faltering. E.P. Stout relays that, and I quote, "Nichols was notified that at his next attempt to make trouble, a rope and noose would be used on him." In such recollection, we see the distinction in noting the brotherly love element across the river mentioned earlier. The Denver City Town Company records are a hodgepodge of entries, unsystematic and undated in many instances, and I quote, "not so systematically kept as that of the Aurarians, and there is considerable confusion in the entries, either by design or by record." Of the 41 original stockholders recorded in Book A of the Arapahoe County Records of Deeds, Charles Blake, H.P.A. Smith, and L.J. Winchester are known to have been Freemasons. The Leavenworth Party had arrived with members deputized by the Kansas Territory to organize Arapahoe County, including Brother H.P.A. Smith, who was appointed as probate judge. The party included men practiced in real estate speculation, including General William Larimer, Jr., and, I quote, "experienced town promoter." Their mission was clear. They had decided to name their settlement after the governor of Kansas Territory, General James William Denver, perhaps as an inspiration to validate recognition of their claim by the legislature of Kansas Territory. E.W. Wynkoop, the Arapahoe County Sheriff, after whom Wynkoop Street in Denver is presently named, was deployed to Lawrence, Kansas, in hopes of obtaining an official charter for the newly plotted Denver City and to print the stock certificates necessary for transacting the interests among the members. However, he was unable to exert precedence over the charter already submitted by Adnar French and the St. Charles men who had petitioned the legislature previously, which petition, winding through the bureaucracy of the age, would issue by act of the territorial legislature on the 11th of February in 1859. Signed by the Speaker of the House of Representatives and the President of the Council, St. Charles was the first and only lawfully constituted township in the region. His official determination thwarted, Wynkoop dissembled. He vied to position Denver City interests in the St. Charles Corporation. The agreement entered with Adnar French, the president of the St. Charles Town Company, stipulated no further action would be taken on the plotted land until the St. Charles contingent returned later in the coming spring. With the St. Charles men palliated, Wynkoop returned to Cherry Creek. If, in fact, Wynkoop did make any representations to the Denver City Enterprise regarding St. Charles's soon-to-be-lawful incorporation and their senior claim to the land, he must have been ignored. When French and his associates returned in June of 1859, they found a bustling township already in place. Despite their senior claim to the land and a lawful warrant, there was deemed no actionable remedy available. Innocent third-party transactions had already occurred. The St. Charles's men's protestations ultimately yielded. The last entry in the corporate records of the St. Charles Company denotes the resignation of French as president on the 24th of October in 1859. Thus, the only lawful township, in fact, never existed. On the 17th of January, 1859, the directors of the Auraria Town Company, comprising at least a quorum of masons, decided to donate land to the fraternity and resolved that there be and hereby is donated to the Masonic and Oddfellows Associations one lot each. The lodge might have been constructed quickly. In his Illustrated Guide of Denver, published in 1891, Barbot claims that a Masonic lodge was instituted in January of 1859 by Henry Allen. The board also resolved to give one lot each to the first four religious societies that built churches in Auraria. Meeting in various log cabins roundabout, the first lodge was located on Cherry Street between 2nd and 3rd until it was moved to the second story of the Buddy and Jacob store in the fall of 1859. From mid-1859, in the codification of the town alongside masonry, the historic record arrives. The first issue of the Rocky Mountain News was published 23rd of April, 1859. At the top of the classified section on page 2, an ad is seen to read, Masonic. The Arapahoe Lodge of Free and Ancient Masons meets every Saturday night at their lodge on Cherry Street, Auraria, Kansas Territory. H.A. Smith, Secretary. H. Allen, Worshipful Master. Nota bene, visiting brethren are respectfully invited to attend. Organization of the craft is represented alongside the early Auraria Township, with Henry Allen serving as master. With H.A. Smith as secretary, also serving as secretary to the Denver City Town Company, although nominal to the secretary of the board, William Larimer Jr., suggests that the stockholders of the rival corporations must have enjoyed some fraternal affection. Masonry must have provided common ground. Indeed, in his recollections of the time, J.D. Ramage states that, "We agreed to meet every Saturday night, and as our object in locating in Colorado was to get gold, we were supposed to be out prospecting during the week, we decided that any ideas concerning the country we were in, which might come to us, news of any mines we might discover, or any information which might be beneficial to the brethren, Masonically or financially, would, at the next meeting, be given to the Masons there assembled. We had some very pleasant meetings. Such mutual support must have been well proved." In addition to the prominent ad for Arapahoe Lodge on page 2, we find at least two letters to the editor from Masons, one by H.P.A. Smith and the other by William Slaughter. Both hinted, in subtext, at the reward of continued exertion and to remain in the vicinity therefore. The press had been brought by oxcart from Omaha, by William Newton Byers, who, having left March 8, 1859, with the thawing frosts, arrived 40 days later, on the 17th of April, 1859. Byers was an important Nebraskan as well as Coloradoan, having surveyed and founded Omaha City. Byers was likely already a Freemason at this time, although he did not formally join Auraria Lodge until February 2, 1861. Clark, in his Masonry Came to Colorado, states that Byers attended a meeting of the Masonic group the first night he was here. Several additional clues to Byers' affiliation are suggested in the first issue of the Rocky Mountain News, not least the letters to the editor from fellow Masons that helped fill up the space, and the prominent ad for Arapahoe Lodge on page 2, but also, perhaps, among the alphabetical conundrums he authored on page 1. A few of which may be of interest to Masons. Why is the letter A like a meridian? Because it is the middle of day. Why is the letter G like wisdom? Because it is the beginning of greatness and goodness. Why is the letter H like the dying words of John Quincy Adams? This is the end of earth. Now, you may be wondering what that last has to do with Masonry. Well, note that in substantiating his political aspirations, John Quincy Adams had ridden the anti-Masonic ticket in the 1830s and lost the presidential bid to Andrew Jackson, the past Grand Master of Tennessee. Adams had died in 1848. Beyer's Masonic affiliation likely assisted him complete the first newspaper to be distributed in the mining camp. It certainly helped fill up the second page, narrowly beating out rival publisher Jack Merrick by as little as 20 minutes to circulation. Merrick had arrived on April 13th, 4 days previous to Byers. But Byers was connected. On the 22nd of April, 1859, just 5 days after his arrival, the Auraria Board of Directors granted Byers shares in the town to set up shop immediately. The fact that at least 3 of the 5 members of the Auraria Board of Directors were Masons, including its president, is of interest here. Byers' narrow victory to produce the first paper was seminal. Merrick resigned as publisher after producing but 1 issue of the Cherry Creek Pioneer, purportedly sold his equipment to Byers for some flour and bacon, and took up prospecting instead. The Rocky Mountain News would become an important tool in the administration of society in the fledgling city. The influence of Freemasonry in its establishment should not be understated. As an aside, it is worth noting the challenges of initiating a business in a mining camp on the frontier, outside the United States, in this time. In his rush to get the first paper printed, Byers first set up his press in the upper story of Wooten's building. He strung a canvas sheet to protect the press from leaks in the roof from the melting snow, and the printers slept on stacked wooden boards during production. There was a saloon underneath, and the occasional stray gunshot posed a ready enough threat to warrant the concern. Wooten himself records Byers' first question of his hires, whether he could handle a gun to good advantage. On the 6th of May, 1859, John Gregory changed everything when he discovered gold at the headwaters of Clear Creek, approximately 40 miles west of Denver. This brought settlement in earnest to Black Hawk, Central City, and Nevadaville, clinging to the Alpine Valleys, and at the lower elevation of Golden City, about 15 miles west of Denver. Among the seekers of manifest destiny, evanescent in the mountain peaks, Masons found companionship and support. The suddenness of the situation and the network Masonry enabled is well synopsized by William Slaughter regarding the first meeting held in Central City sometime in June, 1859. About the first day of June, 1859, they had assembled in and around Gregory Gulch, where Central City and Black Hawk now stand, fully 20,000 men, and it was decided that there ought to be a rallying place for Masons, hundreds of whom were to be found among this vast crowd. A consultation of those known to each other as Masons was held at Slaughter and Sopras's cabin, and it was resolved to build a lodge room. The word was passed about among all those claiming to be Masons, and about the 15th of June, a site was selected for the lodge room. Work was begun immediately, and the ground leveled for the building, and from 50 to 100 men with horses and ox teams were cutting and dragging logs for the new temple, which, as near as I now remember, was about 30 feet square. Within 2 or 3 days, the walls were up and chinked and plastered with mud inside and out. A pole roof covered with pine boughs, and this covered with several inches of earth, completed the lodge room building. The 3 stations were made of pine logs, sawed to the proper height, hewed and sunk in the ground, with a shorter block of the same material planted by it for a seat. The secretary's desk was the end gate of a wagon box, nailed on top of a post set in the ground and covered with a piece of wagon cover canvas, with a block of wood for a seat. I do not remember the exact date of the first meeting in the new lodge room, but I think it was about the 20th of June, 1859. I shall never forget that first meeting on the mountainside. Word had been passed out among the Masons of the several camps that a Masonic meeting would be held that night at dusk, and as the hour arrived, the trails and paths leading toward the temple began to be lined with Masons gathering together to meet each other from distant states and countries for the first time in this wild place amid the pine woods on a lone mountainside. 4 men, Masons, armed with rifles and revolvers, stood on guard, 1 at each corner of the temple, and 1 at the outer door also. At the outer door, there was a receiving committee to whom each visitor was introduced or made himself known if he were unacquainted with anyone. There were over 200 visiting brethren whose names were entered upon the journal or roll of visitors, as it was called, at that first meeting. A meeting was held once a week for over 3 months. These meetings were, of course, informal and were held for the purpose of forming acquaintance with each other. On the 15th of August, 1859, Richard R. Rees, Grand Master of the Grand Lodge of Kansas Territory, issued dispensation for Auraria Lodge. The petition was entered by members of Leavenworth Lodge No. 150 in Kansas Territory. Henry Allen was appointed master. The first meeting under dispensation was held on October 1st, 1859, on the upper floor of the newly erected Buddy and Jacobs building. Albert Buddy had arrived in Denver City in Auraria sometime in mid-1859. He was member of Herman Lodge No. 37 in Quincy, Illinois. His partner, Abraham Jacobs, a Bavarian Jew, was a member of Capitol Lodge No. 3 in the Nebraska Territory. Commission merchants, they built their grocery store in early October 1859 on the corner of Ferry Street and 4th, which is now Walnut, as an auction house and a stage line. More than 40 Masons are said to have been in attendance at this historic meeting. The minutes record 27 visitors. The minutes also record the dispensation received, written out in longhand, delivered by past Deputy Grand Master of Missouri, D.P. Wallingford, who presided. A photograph of the minutes of this historic meeting is preserved in the 50th anniversary of Denver Lodge, No. 5, Ancient Free and Accepted Masons, 1859 to 1909, which was published by the Denver Lodge at the semi-centennial observance. 3 months later, on the 5th of November, 1859, the minutes record Auraria Lodge adopting a motion to recommend a charter for Denver City Lodge to the Grand Lodge of Kansas Territory. At the very next meeting, 26th of November, 1859, another petition, this time for Golden City Lodge, was adopted for recommendation to the Grand Lodge of Kansas Territory. Thus, we see Auraria Lodge principally involved in the chartering of other lodges in the region, the first hub upon which regularity would turn. Denver City Lodge would shortly merge back with Auraria Lodge to form Denver Lodge. However, as a result of, I quote, a series of most unfortunate events caused by Indian deprivations, swollen streams, and the many other difficulties attendant upon travel, Denver Lodge, despite being the oldest bastion tending the Masonic light in the region, would be instituted as Number 5, receiving its charter at the first annual communication of the Grand Lodge of Colorado on December 10, 1861, succeedant to Golden City Lodge No. 1, established October 17, 1860 as Golden City Lodge No. 34 under the Grand Lodge of Kansas Territory. Summit Lodge No. 2, established the 5th of June, 1861 as Summit Lodge No. 7 under the Grand Lodge of Nebraska. Rocky Mountain Lodge No. 3, established 5th of June, 1861 as Rocky Mountain Lodge No. 8, Grand Lodge of Nebraska. And Nevada Lodge No. 4, established the 15th of October, 1861 as Nevada Lodge No. 36, Grand Lodge of Kansas Territory. The Colorado Territory was created on the 28th of February in 1861, removing the jurisdiction from Kansas Territory. Consequently, a Masonic convention was held at Golden City on August 2, 1861, for the purposes of forming a Grand Lodge for the Territory of Colorado, with representatives from Golden City Lodge No. 34, Summit Lodge No. 7, and Rocky Mountain Lodge No. 8 present. Denver Lodge is conspicuously absent. John Shivington was elected Grand Master. The lodges were renumbered, and the Constitution, bylaws, rules, and regulations were presented and adopted. The first annual communication of the Grand Lodge of Colorado was held in Golden City 4 months later, on the 10th of December, 1861. Organization of the Grand Lodge occurred concurrently with the move to statehood. Amid the backdrop of the American Civil War, statehood would be delayed. But when Colorado would emerge as a new state of the Union 15 years after the formation of its Grand Lodge in 1876, it would adopt boundaries entirely coextensive with the Masonic jurisdiction. Masonry is salient in the history of Denver and the founding of Colorado, no doubt partly due to the diverse population drawn to the region by the allure of gold. Masonry's role in uniting those who would otherwise remain at a perpetual distance seems particularly notable to good effect on the American frontier. The minutes of Denver Lodge No. 5, for example, show that in the first few years of its existence, Auraria Lodge entertained visitors from 30 states and 4 foreign countries. It is inevitable that Masonry, as a source of self-governance in assembly for the peaceable transaction of business, would furnish community leaders. Thus, we see Mason's principle in framing the laws of self-governance that arose in the quest for law and order on the frontier. Brother William Slaughter wrote in his diary, "Just to think that within 2 weeks of the arrival of a few dozen Americans in a wilderness, they set to work to elect a delegate to the United States Congress and asked to be set apart as a new territory." The first movement to establishing a definite civil government of sovereign powers is recorded in the first issue of the Rocky Mountain News. Masons are salient. At the ensuing meeting held 3 days later to appoint delegates to attend a convention representing the interests in the region in pursuit of statehood, Henry Allen was called to preside. Delegates nominated included Masons Henry Allen, Levi Russell, William Slaughter. Of the 6 delegates representing Denver City, recorded at the convention held April 15th in 1859, Masons H.P.A. Smith and C.H. Blake are notable. L.J. Winchester, brother, is recorded as a delegate for El Dorado. A committee to prepare an address to the people of the territory was appointed and included L.J. Russell, H.P.A. Smith, and L.J. Winchester, all Masons. The first trading house in Denver was opened by Masons C.H. Blake and A.J. Williams. C.A. Cook, Denver's second mayor elected in 1861, was a member of Denver Lodge No. 5 at least by 1863. Masons fill out the committees appointed to determine the meets and bounds of self-governance. William Newton Byers on boundaries and Bill of Rights. William Slaughter on suffrage and distribution. Henry Allen on the Judiciary Committee. Levi Russell, education and school funds. And L.J. Winchester and H.P.A. Smith on the scheduling committee. Henry Allen, a delegate to the first constitutional convention to form the state of Jefferson, served as president of the Territorial Council of the Territory of Jefferson. His name appends the laws adopted in December of 1859. By 1862, with the arrival of John Evans, the second governor of Colorado Territory, appointed by Abraham Lincoln, who was a personal friend of Evans, Masonry would occupy the highest office in the Rockies. Evans, affiliated in Attica, Ohio in the early 1840s, was a charter member of Union Lodge No. 7. Union 7 was formed in 1863 by members of Denver Lodge No. 5 due to the irreconcilable division between the Unionist members, including Evans and Chivington, and sympathizers with the Confederacy. And it is perhaps ironic to note that Evans and Chivington, so staunchly anti-slavery, who fought for the equal rights of all citizens under the law, would become best remembered for their unfortunate roles in the horrendous massacre of Arapaho and Cheyenne camped at Sand Creek in 1864. There's much more that could be said here. If you're interested in more detail regarding these early years in Colorado and Masonry's prominent role, please see my paper in the upcoming edition of Ars Quatuor Coronatorum. In conclusion, it seems inevitable that, wherever present, Masonry serves as a construct for social and moral instruction, as a blueprint for organization and municipal incorporation, as a nexus for management, administration, and the dissemination of information across an illiterate population. Freemasonry unites disparate parties under a common identity, allied in purpose. It provides the meeting ground, an example for tested self-governance, and offers the forum where such administration may be practiced. And, perhaps most importantly, it offers a network of necessary relief. Freemasonry carried these precepts with it into the Western United States, riding the winds of manifest destiny like seeds of civility to yield law and order into the chasm of cultural controversy. Perhaps nowhere is this more evident than in the settling of the American West. Well, don't go anywhere, because I'm about to begin on Chapter 4 of De Occulta Philosophia Libri Tres by Heinrich Cornelius Agrippa von Nettensheim. Frankly, I'm absolutely exhausted after a weekend in the desert hunting for paranormal activity with my good friend and brother R.J. Johnson, but we have momentum going, and I need to get this out tomorrow, so hang tight. And I'll be right back. Chapter 4. Of a threefold consideration of the elements. There are, then, as we have said, four elements. Without the perfect knowledge whereof, we can effect nothing in magic. Now each of them is threefold, so that the number of four may make up the number of 12. And by passing by the number of 7 into the number of 10, there may be a progress to the supreme unity upon which all virtue and wonderful operation depends. Of the first order are the pure elements, which are neither compounded nor changed, nor admit of mixture, but are incorruptible, and not of which, but through which the virtues of all natural things are brought forth into act. No man is able to declare their virtues, because they can do all things upon all things. He which is ignorant of these shall never be able to bring to pass any wonderful matter. Of the second order are elements that are compounded, changeable, and impure, yet such as may by art be reduced to their pure simplicity, whose virtue, when they are thus reduced to their simplicity, doth above all things perfect all occult and common operations of nature, and these are the foundation of the whole natural magic. Of the third order are those elements which originally and of themselves are not elements, but are twice compounded, various and changeable one into the other. They are the infallible medium, and therefore are called the middle nature, or soul of the middle nature. Very few there are that understand the deep mysteries thereof. In them is, by means of certain numbers, degrees, and orders, the perfection of every effect in what thing soever, whether natural, celestial, or super-celestial. They are full of wonders and mysteries, and operative, as in magic natural, so divine, for from these, through them, proceed the bindings, loosings, and transmutations of all things, the knowing and foretelling of things to come, also the driving forth of evil, and the gaining of good spirits. Let no man, therefore, without these three sorts of elements, and the knowledge thereof, be confident that he is able to work anything in the occult sciences of magic and nature. But whosoever shall know how to reduce those of one order into those of another, impure into pure, compounded into simple, and shall know how to understand distinctly the nature, virtue, and power of them in number, degrees, and order, without dividing the substance, he shall easily attain to the knowledge and perfect operation of all natural things and celestial secrets. Well, that's it. Thank you for listening this far. Stay tuned to the Rocky Mountain Mason podcast. I hope we'll have some interesting episodes for you upcoming in the future. I do look forward to relaying at least some of my recent adventure with RJ Johnson in the Uinta Basin in Utah. Out there in the desert beneath the blistering sun, strange things are known to happen. If you want to know what, it's not what you expect. Stay tuned. And until next time, take care and Godspeed.